pull up the presentation materials for Carlos Pachon. And again, I'd like to continue to welcome those of you who are joining us for today's internet seminar on the adaptation of Superfund cleanup to climate change. Carlos, whenever you're ready to begin, please do.
Thank you, Jean. Good afternoon, everybody. I think it's afternoon for most of us. My name is Carlos Pachon. I'm an environmental protection specialist here with the Superfund program in our headquarters office in Washington, D.C. It's my pleasure to introduce this webinar and on the topic of climate change adaptation in our program. Let me just find the button for the slides. Here we go. Okay. So I'm going to give you a brief introduction and outline some basic concepts of climate change adaptation. This is a course, a lot of this material was extracted from a course that we delivered for our remedial project managers last year, and we have updated it for the purpose of this webinar and also compressed it a little bit. So I'll be giving you some introductions, some basic concepts, and how, from a national level, some policies and similar approaches have trickled down to the program level. I will then hand it off to my colleague, Ann Daly, who is also here with headquarters, here in the same room, and she'll be covering how climate change adaptation is integrated into site operations here in the Superfund program. She'll be covering some information that is particularly relevant to Superfund adaptation efforts. After that, we're fortunate to have two remedial project managers currently in our regional offices. They're both from our Region 2 office in New York City. And the first one is Joe Battipaglia, who will be introducing his experiences at Hurricane Irene at Raritan River, New Jersey. And then Young Chang, also with our Region 2 office, who will be covering lessons learned from ice dams at a Grass River Superfund site in New York State. I'll introduce each of them a little bit more thoroughly when I finish with my material. At the end of their discussions, we'll have an extensive Q&A, but after each speaker, you're free to ask specific clarification or technical questions related to the topic. However, for broader questions, we suggest you bring those up at the end. We have reserved a good time for Q&A, and we do expect we may be able to finish a little bit before the two-hour time slot we've established for ourselves for this webinar. So let's talk a little bit about the concepts of climate change. In response to the Earth's warming oceans and atmosphere, precipitation patterns are changing. Across the nation, in fact, across the world, the amount of rain falling in the heaviest precipitation events is increasing. And climate models suggest that this trend will continue. Models also suggest that total precipitation will increase in northern states here in the U.S. and decrease in the Southwest. Now, these heavy precipitation events may increase the frequency of flooding along inland waterways and many areas of the United States, while in other areas, decreases in the amount of water available to the natural environment pose threats to the viability of land and aquatic ecosystems. These projected changes in climate change over the next century have the potential to alter patterns in the environment and will affect a natural in phenomena such as wildfires, air quality, and human activities such as agriculture. Many institutions in the public and private sector are looking closely at how climate change may affect their interests, some for economic self-interest, others because of regulations and policies, and in some cases because it is their mission or it may affect their mission. So bringing it down to the Superfund program, what is our role here in addressing or concerning ourselves with climate change adaptation? Well, there are two basic questions that will help us answer this, those two that we have on the slide. The first one, at an agency level, that is across all EPA cleanup programs, we should ask ourselves, how is climate change likely to affect the ability of our office to achieve its mission and strategic goals? At a site level, so that is at an actual Superfund cleanup project, The question a remedial project manager would ask of themselves is, how is climate change likely to affect the protectiveness of my remedy, and what should I do about it? Going off those two questions, let's go into some definitions that are also, in a way, an outline of today's briefing and a summary of what we are doing at Superfund with respect to climate change adaptation, all rolled up, if you like, into one slide. That first higher-level definition, of course, climate change, is any significant change in the measure of climate lasting for an extended period of time. It includes major changes in temperature, precipitation, or wind patterns, among others, that occur over several decades or longer. Now, those climate change changes may result in a vulnerability, which is the degree to which a system is susceptible to or unable to cope with adverse effects of climate change, including climate variability and extremes. Vulnerability is a function of the character, magnitude, and rate of climate variation to which a system is exposed, its sensitivity, and its adaptive capacity. Now, only because we understand that climate change may have effect on a system, that system may face a vulnerability, does not mean we have to take action, as an impact does not necessarily always have consequences. However, if there's a high vulnerability, a very high vulnerability maybe, and a low impact, or a low vulnerability and a very high impact, that is when we may decide that we have to take action. The nature of that action is climate change adaptation. That is adjusting to changing climate to minimize negative effects and take advantage of new opportunities, although that's not going to be, that latter part is not going to be the focus of this webinar. The purpose of taking this action is to build resilience into our system. In the case of the Superfund program, looking at building resilience into the remedies that have been put in place to protect human health and environment from exposure to contaminants. And we want to build a resilience which is defined as a capacity to anticipate, prepare for, respond to, and recover from multi-hazard threats with minimum damage to social well-being, the economy, and the environment. Okay, move on to the next slide. So a little bit of background, a very basic concept here. Starting within the agency, there was a U.S., this is chronological, there was a U.S. policy statement on climate change adaptation. Seems like a very long time ago, but it was only 2011, directing each national program office and region to develop a climate change adaptation implementation plan by June of 2013. That is when we started some of the work I'm going to describe now, and it fed into the EPA Climate Change Adaptation Report, which we'll cover in just a second. In 2013, there was an executive order which directed each federal agency in the United States to evaluate climate change risk and vulnerabilities to manage the effects of climate change on the agency's mission and operations in both the short and long term. And then finally, in 2014, the agency released the Climate Change Adaptation Report. I won't go into too much detail in that one, but there are a series of action plans for each of the agency's major programs, air, water, waste, et cetera, as well as each of the 10 regional offices. So it's a matrix approach to looking at how we need to adapt to climate change with a total of 17 action plans under that report. As before we move forward, one of the areas I work in here in Superfund is a greener cleanups, green remediation, addressing the environmental footprint of our implementing our mission. And I often get this question. In fact, I get it so often, I decided to put a slide on it. What is the difference when we talk about climate change between adaptation and mitigation? They seem quite similar, and they're often spoken of in the same context. While we continue to pursue reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, which is the mitigation side, here in Superfund, we must prepare to handle impacts from climate change that is already happening. That is the adaptation side. So in Superfund, through green remediation practices, we seek to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to mitigate climate change, among other goals in green remediation. And through this adaptation, we seek to ensure remedy resilience in the face of climate change impacts. So before we launch into any specific actions, climate change adaptation actions that we are implementing in the Superfund program, I thought we'd stop to look at where we were in 2011 before we got started down this path, and looked closely at climate change adaptation and our program to see where we might have to take some action. We're sharing this information to provide you with a feel for the nature and scope of what it is that we're working with in the program in relation to climate change. What we did is we undertook climate change vulnerability analysis across our most common remedies. We could consider this a portfolio analysis. We developed a matrix of remedy sensitivity to climate change, and we rated the relative vulnerability of the individual remedies to these climate change scenarios. This is that risk times the vulnerability discussion we had just a couple of minutes ago. We screened our frequent and potentially vulnerable remedies, and we did a GIS plot of those remedies based on site latitude, longitude coordinates. And then we focused on a subset of higher vulnerability and more frequent remedies. Based on those that subset, we conducted desk audits of five potentially vulnerable remedies and use these as case studies. And from this, we drew some conclusions and recommendations for further work, which we'll discuss in today's presentation. So this is that, it's based on professional judgment. We worked both in-house and with some extramural technical expertise to develop this. This is a portfolio analysis. This is not indicative necessarily of vulnerabilities of any specific remedy to any specific climate change scenarios, but it helped us understand where we might focus our attention. On the left-hand side, on the left-hand column, you have the most common remedy types in the Superfund program, be they in situ, that is underground, be they ex situ, above ground, or for source control, generally soil and DNAPL, or for groundwater. And then across the x-axis, you've got the most common climate change scenarios, flooding, inundation, extreme storms, et cetera. What we did is, again, using professional judgment, determine how would a specific remedy be impacted by each of these climate change scenarios, and rated as no known or potential expected impacts through to major impacts such as total loss of remedy functionality and effectiveness, and potential for contaminant release. So the next step was to plot our MPL sites using that GIS analysis we described earlier. And we decided to look at the two specific scenarios, that is changes in flooding and also sea level rise. So this is just to give you an example of what the first map looked like, plotting all of the MPL sites on the continental United States without Alaska, and identifying them as falling into a 100-year floodplain or 500-year floodplain, and either adjacent or unmapped but probable. Well, we repeated this a couple of times with several layers. And we found that of the 1,639 sites on the MPL at the time of the analysis, 521 were within 100-year floodplains or within 1.5-meter mean sea level rise. And the following analysis I'm going to walk you through briefly is a summary of pump and treat and containment remedies at those 521 sites. Why pump and treat? One of the reasons is because of high infrastructure costs associated with remedies at those sites, the presence of a physical plant that could be impacted, long operating life typically associated with these types of remedies, and the high number of remedies. We know there are at least 600 have at some point been selected at MPL sites. as with containment, also there's a high number of remedies and contaminants remaining on site could potentially be mobilized by some of these impacts from flooding or from sea level rise. So we looked at these remedy types in those zones of susceptibility, and our finding was for those major types on the left, on-site disposal, containment, groundwater pump and treat, and then combinations of those remedies, we found that there were a total of 24 sites that had one of those remedies and were in either 100 year floodplain, 1 meter sea level rise, or combinations of 1 meter, 1.5 meter, and 500 year layers on that GIS analysis. So we took those of those 24 projects, we took five, took a closer look at them as a desktop analysis, a desktop audit, if you like, and interviewed the project managers to evaluate the vulnerability, potential vulnerability, and the degree to which climate change impacts have been or were being addressed at those sites, which, by the way, were located in Florida, New Jersey, Virginia, and Washington State. In general, our findings indicated that sites were found to have low or no vulnerabilities to climate change scenarios. However, there were some vulnerabilities, and where those existed, they were often identified early and factored into remedy selection, design, and operations. Some of the sites that were considered to be vulnerable by the project team had operation maintenance plans, for example, to address flooding. In other words, that was part of their resilience, what had been worked into operation and maintenance plans. And we might see some of that from our later speakers. One thing to note is that many sites use historic flood data for future analyses. There's a recent executive order that directs federal agencies where tax dollars are being spent to consider new analyses for that. We'll be discussing that a little bit further. And if you're interested in that, do send me an email, and we will be updating our website. We just received that at the end of January. We're still looking at how it affects our program. Also, for long-term remedial actions, in Superfund, five-year reviews offer an opportunity to consider potential for climate change adaptation needs in situations where we have already moved beyond remedy selection, remedy design, construction, and operation. So what are we doing in the Superfund program? What are those major climate change adaptation activities that have resulted from these analyses and these findings? Well, there are five major ones. The first is to develop a protocol for remedial project managers to assess vulnerabilities in designing and implementing a remedy. We've discussed that in very general terms. We're continuously refining it, and we'll be presenting an updated analysis at the next remedial project managers. For those RPMs on the call, if you are going to NARPM in the fall, be on the lookout for a four-hour course on this topic, and we'll be discussing that in more detail then. We're also developing a series of adaptation fact sheets for high-risk, long-term, relatively expensive, and frequent remedies. And daily, we'll be covering a couple of those we've released so far on groundwater remedies and on containment and capping remedies. We're also identifying how existing Superfund processes, such as remedial investigation feasibility study, design, remedial action, and five reviews can include adaptation actions that ensure continued protectiveness. And again, Anne will be covering that in some more detail. We're developing training materials and programs, including open access webinars such as this one, and in-house training for our remedial project managers. And we continue to coordinate with legal enforcement teams to help anticipate scenarios that we may encounter in the future. So in summary, to address climate change adaptation at our sites, basic concepts are screen, remedy for climate change related vulnerabilities, conduct a sensitivity analysis to screen out low probability, low impact vulnerabilities, then evaluate adaptation measures available and applicable to address the vulnerabilities and how these may increase the remedy resilience, the remedy's resilience, and then implement those adaptation measures. So if you have already done this, you're working with Superfund or another cleanup program, have already completed such an analysis, we'd love to hear of your case study so we could write it up and get the word, good word out. Here's the first URL you might want to bookmark and reference, as we do maintain it and keep it current. So that's the last of my slides, Jean. I hand it back to you.
Okay.
Questions, and then I'll introduce Anne.
All right, excellent. So just a reminder, you can submit your comments and questions for our presenters using the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen at any time. We did have a few that came in electronically, and I'm going to start with those first. This very first one is a simple one. They were commenting on the concept between mitigation and adaptation. This participant asks, or summarizes it as, mitigation is reactive. Adaptation is a projection of the potentials that have not yet been experienced. Would you say that that's an accurate summary?
Yes, I think that's, yes, that's correct.
All right, excellent. We did have another question about the 500-year floodplain. One of your participants would like to know how you settled on using the 500-year floodplain and a 1.5-meter sea level rise in your work.
Good question. The 500-year floodplain did come up later in the executive order I mentioned earlier, where it is federal agencies have been directed to use a 500-year floodplain. Honestly, I can't recall back in 2011 why we chose those four parameters. We wanted a range. It wasn't necessarily a likelihood associated with each one of those. We wanted to see how fast sites screened out as we increased or decreased the probability. So there's no exact probability associated with each one of those, but it was basically to establish a range.
So information was available, too.
And
that information is readily available.
Correct. And that information had been done by NOAA,
FEMA.
USGS, FEMA.
Yeah.
So those levels, good point, Ann, were available. So, but there's no specific probability associated. Other than that, there's no particular reason why we chose those two.
Okay. We have another participant that wanted to know if the remedy sensitivity matrix is available on EPA's website.
No, but it's available on this PowerPoint.
All right, excellent. Do you think you'll be posting it on EPA's website sometime soon?
I think it may be available somewhere on the climate change site we mentioned earlier.
Okay. All right, we do have a few other questions that came in. I think we've got enough time to keep going with these. One of your participants wants to know about earthquake vulnerabilities. These are particularly problematic in the Pacific Northwest. Are you addressing earthquake vulnerabilities in your work here?
Yes, I should say yes. Indirectly, if you look at landslides in the matrix we showed earlier, you'll see that one's all red, and that's one of the higher results or impacts of an earthquake is often landslides. So directly we are. We did get that question from a lot of our project managers. Looking at remedies individually, we determined that many of those would be covered under those climate change scenarios we've addressed. And then, of course, this is a climate change adaptation analysis versus earthquake resilience analysis. So I think that more or less answers the question.
Okay. Someone commented that the USGS has revised their water resources bulletin, where they're predicting floodplains based on historical data, and they're using some new statistical methods. Have you reviewed that draft bulletin, and how are you incorporating it in your climate change adaptation?
So the specific bulletin that is mentioned by the caller or by the participant, I have not read it. A lot of the work that we're doing in compiling information resources relevant to project managers is precisely to answer that type of question. So how a project manager at any specific site would work and help them identify what information, such as floodplain analysis, which is the go-to source in the federal government, and which is the one that's most likely to have information that's actionable for them at their site, at a scale that they can use, be it USGS, be it FEMA, whoever it is that is releasing that that information and updating it, and providing, for example, a 500-year floodplain based on climate change scenarios rather than historical flood data. And I think that's basically what that USGS map is going to, using a predictive modeling information on precipitation, changing precipitation patterns rather than historical analysis of empirical evidence of flooding.
Okay. I'm going to, a number of other questions have popped in. Some of these are getting very specific into impacts of particular types of climate change. So I'm going to hold those off. I think we might talk about some of these other specific weather incidences in the case studies. But what I did want to ask was one very general question, and they want to know if you're looking at other things other than flood vulnerability. For example, storms, tornadoes, hurricanes. Have you looked at other inclement weather situations in your work?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll go into that in my presentation.
All right, yes. Excellent.
The analysis I showed was the ones that are most likely, they're the most common across the program, across our portfolio, I should say. Tornadoes in the Northeast aren't that common or in the Southwest, but flooding and sea level rise are common to all our 10 regions, and that's one of the reasons we showed you that analysis and conducted that first analysis. But some of the fact sheets that Ann's going to go through, you'll see there's some examples of how those remedies may be vulnerable to climate change scenarios other than sea level rise and flooding.
Yeah, like temperature, precipitation, wind, sea level rise.
Webinar. Just as a reminder to participants, you can continue to submit your comments and questions using that Q&A window at any time. Great job with the questions so far. And we will take continued breaks, so if we haven't asked your question yet, we may have some time at the end to bring it in. Carlos?
Okay, so our next speaker is Ann Bailey, a colleague of ours here. She is currently an environmental scientist in the Superfund headquarters here in Washington, D.C., working on several aspects of Superfund remedy implementation, including climate change and groundwater remedies. She also served as the National Superfund Completions Coordinator and the Superfund Tribal Coordinator. And for the previous 20 years before coming to D.C., I think it was like 3 years ago?
Yeah, 3 years ago.
3 years ago. She was in the EPA Region 10 offices in Seattle. And while she was in Region 10, she was a Superfund remedial project manager for about half that time, about 12 years, and also worked for 10 years in the water program. And has a Bachelor of Science in Geology and a Master of Science in Oceanography. Ann?
Great. Thanks, Carlos, for the introduction. So pleased to be here today to talk with everybody about the EPA priority of integration of climate change into our Superfund work. And so as part of my talk today, I'm going to cover that, talk about some potential issues that may be considered at Superfund sites. And again, this is all site-specific. And also describe the Superfund project manager's role in this whole effort. Also include some illustration of the many places where consideration of climate change adaptation can easily fit within the Superfund process. I mean, we're very lucky with Superfund that we've got a great context in which to fit consideration of climate change. And then I'm going to close with a few summary points. Okay, as you just heard from Carlos's presentation, Superfund's response to the President's call to action regarding climate change, which fits really well into the Superfund mission to protect human health and the environment. And as everyone on this call, I think, certainly realizes, EPA and others have invested substantial investments in terms of monetary and effort and motivation in terms of Superfund remedies. And it's really important that we keep those remedies in place in face of the changing climate. But the good news is there's a lot of opportunities to potentially increase resilience of remedies. That's what we'll go over some of that today here. And some of the regional case studies will provide more on that. And I think it's important to always keep in the back of your mind that, as is often the case in many situations, this is just another situation where luck favors the prepared. Okay, the EPA Climate Change Adaptation Plan, as Carlos mentioned, there is 17 different plans put together. Each of the regions have one, and then each of the offices, at program offices and headquarters has a separate plan. But there's kind of this overarching theme of different potential climate change impacts that should be considered in all the plans. And this is a simple matrix that on this graphic that portrays those. And, of course, the potential impacts will vary by site and location, for example, proximity to ocean, rivers, and a host of other factors. I think it's interesting to note that there was a thing in the newspaper just a couple days ago I read where there was a site from FEMA saying that about 90% of the disasters in the U.S., natural disasters in the U.S., are in some way linked to flooding. So that's a common, even despite the extreme drought in the West, most natural disasters related to some aspect of flooding, either ocean or a river. Okay, and some of the potential things to think about at Superfund sites, and just to kind of have in the back of your mind as we go through this, is that you know, the past may not be predictive of the future. For example, historic water levels, temperature data, other climate data that is available for the past really may not be predictive of future conditions. In addition, some older remedies may not have fully considered climate change. For example, you know, a remedy that maybe was installed 15, 20 years ago near a river may not reflect the current conditions or current understanding of the floodplain mapping. For example, as we talked earlier about the 500-year floodplain, you know, what might have been on a 500-year floodplain may now, in fact, be in a 100-year floodplain, or some other changes like that that may not have been considered when some older remedies were put in place. And also, another thing to just think about is that, you know, some cleanups, particularly ones that have been in place for a while, may need some strengthening to ensure their resilience going forward. Also, many remedies, you know, are in place for a long time. For example, repositories that may contain hazardous substances may be in place for decades or likely into perpetuity for some remedies. And in some situations, standard practices may no longer be effective depending on what's going on with the climate conditions. For example, extreme drought may affect the effectiveness of caps that may be installed. Also, some processes and protocols may need adjustment to reflect the changing climate to ensure the resilience of Superfund remedies going forward. So this is a few things to kind of think about. But the good news with this whole thing is that the Superfund really already has an excellent process for planning and implementing site cleanups to support identification of site-specific hazards, evaluation of site vulnerability to climate change, consideration of potential impacts, and then implementation of adaptation measures. So that we'll go through some components of that in just a minute. And in terms of project managers, I guess we've adapted these talks to project manager training. I realize some folks on the call maybe are not project managers, but in terms of the project managers or those that maybe support project managers, kind of the key aspects of that role is, you know, really to ask questions, use common sense, you know, think about this stuff, and just make sure you're kind of asking the right questions at, you know, going forward. It's important also to kind of understand the climate change issues in the general area near your site and also near the specific site. And what's likely to happen generally in the area and specifically at the site to the best that data is available. And it's also really good to have an understanding of the potential vulnerabilities at the existing and planned sites and remedies, which was, of course, grows out in number two there. And then, secondly, the RPM or project manager should consider implementation of adaptation measures. You know, more options are available early in the process if you've got a site that's just getting implemented or remedies that are being modified, perhaps. And then, again, it's really important to monitor and update as needed based on potentially new information that may become available or a better understanding of site conditions and the risks that may exist at a site. Okay, moving on, climate change adaptation management for an existing or planned remedy generally should focus on evaluating a remedy systems of vulnerability to climate change. That's a box in the upper left. And I'll go through each one of these in a little more detail with the next couple of slides. So the first box on the left, the upper left, is evaluating a system's vulnerability to climate change, looking at the assessment, assessing the exposure and sensitivity, and then implementing adaptation measures when warranted to ensure that the remedy continues to prevent human or environmental exposure to contaminants of concern. And then, as I just said, you know, circling back and monitoring and periodically reevaluating the system's vulnerability and incorporation of any needed changes, understanding of the site risks and climate impacts. So we'll go through each of these, one of these in a little more detail. Okay, evaluating the remedies vulnerability to climate change typically involves a couple of steps. And Carlos has already talked about some of this, so some of this is a little bit of a repeat. But it's, you know, identification of the climate change hazards of concern. And each, this is specific to each site. You know, the site near the ocean is going to have very different risks than an upland site in Colorado, for example. Characterizing the system's exposure to those hazards of concern, and then characterizing the system's sensitivity and vulnerability to the hazards of concern. And again, all site-specific information that you need to be thinking about for your specific site. But we do have some resources to help with this. In addition, you want to consider other factors that may exacerbate or potentially worsen or may perhaps mitigate the exposure and sensitivity, such as, for example, a long operating period. If you've got, an ex-situ containment system that may operate for a long period of time, as long as the material remains hazardous, that, which could be decades. So it's something you need to consider versus something that maybe will be wrapped up in just a short period of time and that maybe the risk would be less. Okay, then moving on to the second box in the upper right from that other figure, results of the site-specific vulnerability evaluation that I just discussed, you know, may be used to develop a strategy for increasing the remedies system's resilience and ultimately implement adaptation measures at the site. And this includes, you know, such things as identifying current and potential impacts, assessing the risks, and identifying potential adaptation measures, and then working through implementing the ones that seem most promising, and so forth. And of course, working with your site team, work leadership, agency leadership, your partners, and community support. Because a lot of times, a site, Superfund site, may be near other community infrastructure aspects, and you'd want to be working with other community members on some of this stuff, depending on the site again. And so, you know, a few things you may want to consider as you go through this analysis is you know, think about the size and age of the above ground and below ground components of the remedy, again, the anticipated duration of the remedy, how long will it be in place, will it be in place a short time, a long time. Think about the existing infrastructure components that you may be relying on to access the site, for example, roads, power, water system supplies. Can you get to the site if it's flooded by the nearby river? Consider primary and backup means of access, anticipated effectiveness and longevity of the potential adaptation measures. And, of course, always considering the capital costs and operation and maintenance costs of anything that may be implemented. And moving on is, you know, to monitor and periodically reevaluate the process. And it's an iterative and flexible process that would take into account a changing understanding information that you further learn about the site or the effectiveness of adaptation measures and what's going on within the community and the area nearby. Thinking about the status of the response actions, any changes in climate understanding and the remedy's vulnerability, reviewing and evaluating the monitoring measures already taken and adapting that monitoring, changing that monitoring if you're not getting the right information to make the assessment. And then incorporating any of the newly identified information options into the adaptation strategy for the site. Okay, so moving on. So this is just a simple graphic to transition to consideration of where you may consider this within the existing Superfund process, and this is a simple graphic of the remedial process, Superfund remedial process, and I'll go through this in a bit more detail in the next set of slides. Okay, I think probably everybody on this call is pretty familiar with the major phases in the Superfund remedial process. You know, starting essentially with the remedial investigation and feasibility study, where you evaluate the nature and extent of the contamination, human and ecological risks, and develop and screen remedial alternatives to eventually go to remedy selection, remedy design, and then action, and then any post-construction activities required for the specific remedy. Okay, the remedial investigation and feasibility study is a really important spot within the Superfund process to be considering climate change adaptation at the site. So during the remedial investigation, you're evaluating not only the nature and extent of the contamination, but the situation at the site, understanding what's going on with the nearby river, for example, the groundwater, and other things that will play into evaluation of remedial alternatives. And it's really important to consider these things when you're developing a site conceptual site model. You also want to ensure that you're using the best available data and models. And that was brought up earlier in one of the questions, and we'll show you some resources that we've pulled together, and we're continuing to update as we get new information to help make some of that material available, because there are a lot of resources out there. But you want to try and use the best current information for your site and in models. And in some situations, it may be appropriate to contact the local and regional experts, because, you know, for example, a local port authority may have done some focused modeling on the water body nearby and have a better, more focused understanding of what may happen with storm surge in that area, for example. So it's good to kind of look around, not just focus necessarily on the internet, but look around the neighborhood and see who else in your area may have done a lot of work, because a lot of local communities, port authorities, states, counties, and so forth have done a lot of work on some of this stuff and have good information that we should all try to avail ourselves of. In the feasibility study, each remedial alternative is evaluated using the Superfund 9 criteria evaluation, pretty standard practice in Superfund remedy evaluation. And this essentially addresses the statutory requirements, the technical costs, and institutional considerations that EPA has deemed appropriate when evaluating remedial alternatives. The 9 criteria are laid out there on the slide. And of the 9 criteria, the following may be most applicable. They'll all apply, certainly. Probably may be most applicable to consideration of climate change impacts, and that's to be protective of human health and the environment, the long-term protectiveness and permanence, reduction of toxicity, mobility, or volume through treatment, short-term effectiveness, and implementability. Okay, so then using all that information, you get to remedy selection. And during remedy selection, you want to incorporate consideration of the site-specific exposure, remedy vulnerabilities, and adaptation measures, so that you're selecting a remedy that is likely to be most resilient in face of your best understanding of potential climate change impacts at the site. Then remedial design, and then followed by remedial action, but particularly remedial design is a really important spot to consider climate change adaptation. Because, you know, a lot of times you may issue a record of decision, and if it's a large site, for example, or funding is not available or whatever, it may be some time until you actually get to implementing a remedy. So it's important to be aware of any changing understanding of the potential climate impacts at a site before you get to putting pen to paper to do the design. So particularly for new remedial systems, selecting the optimal measures that may maximize the system's resilience to climate change impacts throughout the project life and this can help avoid costly retrofits in the future. So it's really, the design is a super important spot to be thinking about this pretty carefully. And as part of this effort, you want to consider, you know, the below ground components, the at and above ground components, site operations and infrastructure, and then also long-term stewardship. And then finally, the post-construction aspect is important as well. As we all know, many Superfund remedies are already in place and operating. So for existing remedies, there should be periodic reevaluation of potential site vulnerabilities, monitoring the effectiveness of measures already taken, and incorporating newly identified options or information into the adaptation strategy. For example, as we've touched on before, you know, there may be updated floodplain mapping that originally had a site in a 500-year floodplain, but now that's classified in a 100-year floodplain. So things like that, you should be thinking about that as you go through remedy implementation. And the five-year review process is a perfect spot in which to be considering that. As folks who've done five-year reviews are probably well aware that the standard protectiveness assessment for remedies includes a question, question C, which is basically the following question. Has any other information come to light that could call into question the protectiveness of the remedy? And if you look in section 4.3 of the five-year review guidance, it has an example right there that considers possible change in the floodplain boundary as one of those things you might be considering. So it's five-year review provides a perfect opportunity to be thinking about this as you're evaluating the protectiveness of remedies going forward. So it's important to consider if the remedy is functioning as intended, look at the data and assumptions, and any new information that could call into protectiveness of the remedy. And so I'm going to show one example here. And as we mentioned earlier, each region had to put together a adaptation plan. And so one of the things that Region 2, as part of their adaptation implementation plan, identified as a priority action, is to include consideration of potential climate change impacts in five-year reviews at Superfund sites. And so a guidance document was developed by Region 2 that outlines how the region will implement this priority. And it's essentially this decision tree that was put together by Region 2 and then used by project managers as they're doing a five-year review at a specific site. And it essentially looks at, you know, have you seen any of these situations at the site, for example, remedy impairment due to water level rise, flooding, storms, and or winter, and sea level rise, increasing frequency of heavy precipitation events, and so forth. And then has a simple decision tree going through of if you've seen these things, an approach to take, and if not, suggested language to include. And potentially if you need to make, consider making changes to the, for example, the operation and maintenance plan for the site, some ways to do that. So this is just one example of one tool that a region put together that is being implemented currently by the region. Okay, so as Carlos mentioned earlier, we've tried to pull together available resources and information onto the webpage address up there at the top. If you Google Superfund and climate change, this is the first thing that comes up on that that search. So we've got a lot of things on here. I suggest people pull this up after the webinar and take a look at it, see what you can find. But we've tried to hang on here a lot of things in terms of good information sources, a whole bunch of things we've got. Our fact sheets are on here as well. So there's a ton of information as well as all the adaptation plans for the different offices and the agency. So I'd encourage folks to take a look at this and poke around and see what was here. We are updating this as we have new information. We update it as quickly as we can. One of the things I did want to highlight is these climate change adaptation technical fact sheets. This is the groundwater remediation fact sheet. This was the first one we put together because, as Carlos noted, this is the kind of remedy. There's a lot of these groundwater remedies. 90% of cleanups have a groundwater component. So this is a common remedy type, and some of them are potentially vulnerable as well. So we worked with our EPA's groundwater forum and the regional offices as well to put this technical fact sheet together. And it has a number of, it's 8 pages long, so it's fairly succinct. It's a good use of tables, which has a lot of information presented concisely and provides examples of information resources with live links. If you pull this up, the links are live, and so you can get to a whole bunch of information that's helpful. And we've identified considerations for sensitivity assessments and potential adaptation measures to think about groundwater remedy, looking at the extraction or containment systems, above ground components, and below ground components. So these are useful. I think these are useful for people. We also have a fact sheet on already out there on containment systems that's available as well. And there's a link from that webpage I just showed you. And we're also in the final stages of putting one together for sediment remedies. And again, we've worked broadly within the EPA, the technical resources within the EPA to get information to put these things together. So just in closing, a couple key points. This is an agency priority and hence a Superfund priority to address climate change as part of our Superfund work. But we're in a good place because the existing Superfund process provides a really strong structure to consider climate change vulnerability just as part of our normal practice. And as always, it's important to ask questions, use common sense. A lot of this stuff is pretty common sense if you think about it. And it's earlier to incorporate, better to incorporate earlier rather than later, easier to build in up front than retrofit, and luck favors the prepared. And that's it. Thank you for your attention. I appreciate people tagging in today. Yeah, any questions? Or Jean, how do you want to handle that?
Well, I think we're going to double check and see if Carlos is going to field some of these for you. Carlos, if you want me to read through, I'm happy to do that. We do have many of them that have come in electronically.
Yeah, I see. There have been quite a few. I think as Anne was speaking, she was addressing some of these questions. So, good question. let me just ask a couple, and then I'll hand it back to you. If that's okay. So here's one. I think you've kind of like answered one of the last points. The question is an enforcement question. If a site review indicates that adaptive measures are needed for a remedy, could we compel PRPs to implement them? So that's not different from any other five-year review finding. Right?
Yeah, that would be similar with any five-year review. But I know there is a national work group starting to look at some of those issues in our Office of Enforcement. Is looking at those because there may be special provisions of that. But it would be like anything where you like, go through a five-year review and identify an issue that may need to be addressed at a Superfund site. It would be a similar sort of process.
Okay, and here's a similar one that I think you've pretty much covered, but it's one I hear quite often, so I think it's worth repeating. Which balancing criteria will my RPM be looking for or questioning vulnerability and resilience? So under which balancing criteria, or under which criteria will we consider these climate change impacts on our remedy?
Okay. Well, what I had suggested is that the protectiveness of human health in the environment, the first threshold criteria is key, of course. And then under the balancing criteria, the long-term effectiveness and permanence, reduction of toxicity, mobility, and volume through treatment. So if you treat it and it's not still there, and at risk and couldn't be, like, say, spread around as part of a flood, that's good. And short-term effectiveness and implementability would all play into it.
Good, thank you. And there are several related to that as well and similar questions. It says, Jean, I'm not sure if you identify this, the person asking the question. I'm not sure what the policy is.
Yeah, I usually just keep their names off. Oftentimes they're joining in a large group, so the question isn't actually coming from that one person anyway.
Okay, so the question is, as many sites are well into remediation by potentially responsible parties, what approaches do you suggest to engage them in climate change issues?
Well, I think it would be like, you know, any other issues at a site. I mean, perhaps sharing the EPA climate change adaptation plans, probably your region has a plan. Certainly there's the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response Plan, perhaps sharing those with the responsible parties so that they're aware where EPA is coming on this. And we could talk separately, but I mean, those are some ideas. Each region does have a plan and is putting something together. So I would, if it's an EPA regional office person, I would first start with your local people and see what how it's being handled within your regional office, and we'd be happy to talk with you as well.
Right, and I guess there's also the basic question, how to approach it is maybe what you discussed earlier, the life of the site, depending on where you are, feasibility, design, construction, operation, long-term maintenance, And what is that basic question? Is there any scenario, climate change scenario, that may be affecting the protectiveness of the remedy? And if it is, that's a conversation that should be had.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't know, how are we doing on time, Jean? I haven't looked at this. I know
sure.
We have a lot of questions.
You do. I think you probably take one more question now, and then we'll go ahead and move on to the next presentation.
Okay. Well, here's a question that I know our friends in Region 4 have been addressing extensively, and maybe I know you have been working with them as well. Maybe we can both answer this one or they're on the line. But where do environmental justice considerations factor into Superfund climate change vulnerability analysis?
Well, I mean, it's like it would factor in, there's the EJ screen tool that you can take a look at and see where EJ communities are located. That would be certainly one thing, and mapping activities to look at that in the context of the site. And your general knowledge, as you would with incorporating EJ in any consideration of the site. I mean, in some ways it's not terribly different than anything else, but there is the recent issuance of the EJ screening tool to take a look at potential EJ community issues.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much where I would go. We look at EJ from the cumulative negative impacts of environmental conditions and the potential negative impact for climate change scenarios on the community, in addition to any air quality, water quality, contaminated media, et cetera. Would be one more factor to prioritize addressing those types of issues in that community. So,
that's correct. And again, for participants, keep those questions coming in. We appreciate the comments, and we will take another break for questions in just a few moments.
Great. Well, we move on to part three of our webinar. It's my pleasure to introduce Joe Battipaglia from our Region 2 office in New York City. Joe has been with EPA for about 5 years, almost four of those sites. One of the sites he has been working on is American cyanamide, which is the topic of his presentation. Additionally, Joe grew up in northwestern New Jersey, about 50 miles from the site, so it's close to home for him. Joe, are you ready?
Yep, I'm ready to go.
Thank you.
So, the structure to my presentation will kind of look at some background information on the site, and then I'll get into some impacts to the site from Hurricane Irene in 2011, followed by Tropical Storm Lee, and then I'll talk about some of the response to those wet weather events, and then some of the longer-term modifications that we made afterwards to be better prepared in the future, and then propose a few take-home lessons that you guys might be able to apply on projects you work on. So with that, I will flip to the next slide. And so the site's located in Bridgewater Township, New Jersey. It's basically central northern New Jersey, right about where Route 78 meets Route 287, if you're familiar with the area. And the responsible party for the site is Pfizer, and they assumed all environmental liability in 2009 through their acquisition of Wyeth. And the original owner of the site was the American Cyanamide Company, hence the name of the site. And it's been passed around a few times. American Home Products owned it for a while before Wyeth owned it. So it has a pretty extensive history of site ownership. Looking at the figure on the slide, the site's about 435 acres, so can be deceiving, and you might think it can look like a pretty small area, but it's in fact quite a large site, and it's separated into five different areas, which we've simply named the North Area, South Area, East Area, and the West Area, and then there's another area in the northwest corner, the Impoundment 8 facility. So there's five separate areas, and the area itself is a mix of residential and commercial properties. There's a lot going on. One major point, which will of course come up later, is the Raritan River flows, if you can see the pointer on the screen, flows right adjacent to the site. There's residential properties to the east, to the south, and to the northwest. There's a minor league baseball stadium to the north. There is a railroad line running across the site in between the north and the south area. Interstate 287, you can see my cursor, runs between the south area and the east area, so a pretty major highway running through the site. There's also another railroad that runs along the northern edge of the site. So there's a whole lot going on in the area, and that'll come into play later. And one thing to point out, and I'll probably reinforce this a few times in the background section because it's important later on, is two things. One, the entire site is located within the flood hazard area of the Raritan River, with the exception of the Impoundment 8 facility up to the northwest portion of the site. So the remainder is within the flood hazard area. And then one other thing to note is that the north area, which is shown in the yellowish color, is surrounded by a flood control berm. It's basically, it's a 10 to 12 foot berm. It was designed and constructed to prevent floodwaters from getting in for approximately a 100-year flood event. And that wasn't part of any remedy. That was actually dating back historically for site operations. The site owner constructed that berm just to keep the property from getting flooded many, many decades ago. So a little bit more on the history. For about 85 years, the site was used for the manufacture of pharmaceuticals, chemical intermediates, petroleum-based products, dyes and pigments, and through that time, 27 impoundments or lagoons were constructed, so 27 waste disposal areas. And over time, from disposing of waste in these impoundments through the handling and just over time, soil and groundwater also became contaminated. And the primary contaminants are volatiles, semi-volatiles, and metals. And some of the main really risk drivers are benzene, dichlorobenzene, naphthalene, and nitrobenzene, and there's a laundry list of others that I won't get into. And once again, in this figure, there's a lot going on, but the take-home message, and if I can get my cursor, here it is. Two things to point out, and this is what I'm going to focus in on next, is impoundments number 3, 4, and 5, so waste disposal areas, 3, 4, and 5, are in this area here where my cursor is. And then impoundments 1 and 2 are over here just south of the railroad, between the railroad and the river. And what's important to note is impoundments 3, 4, and 5 are within that north area from the previous slide and are actually within a 100-year flood control berm, while impoundments 1 and 2 are outside of that flood control berm and are much closer to the river, and that'll come into play later. So focusing in on impoundments 3, 4, and 5, and the reason I'm focusing in on impoundments 3, 4, and 5 and impoundments 1 and 2 is these are essentially the most highly contaminated areas of the site. So impoundments 3, 4, and 5 are within that 100-year flood control berm. They're about 10 acres total. They vary in depth from 10 to 17 feet deep. You can see an aerial shot on the right. And the contaminants within these impoundments, there's, once again, a very long list of contaminants. But just to give you a flavor, got some pretty high concentrations of benzene, naphthalene, a lot of other volatiles and semi-volatiles, and pHs range from pretty much 1 to 10. And one thing to note is Impoundments 3, 4, and 5 are in the design phase now. We're looking at remedies been selected and calls for in-situ solidification and stabilization of these impoundments just to consider as we move forward. So then impoundments 1 and 2, these are the two impoundments that are outside of that 100-year flood control berm. They're closer to the river, and they're about 2 acres each, and they are about 13 to 16 feet deep, and part of that depth is below grade, part of it is above grade with an earthen berm around it. So essentially, a hole was dug in the ground, waste was disposed, and as it filled up, they created an earthen berm and filled it up a little bit higher. If you can picture that, I wasn't able to get a good visual of it, but you'll see some photos that might help later on. And the waste in here is really nasty. It's worse than what's in impoundments 3, 4, and 5, just to put it very generally. It's a very heterogeneous acid tar byproduct. It consists of two different general layers. There's this hard, crumbly material, and then there's this viscous, tarry material, which you can see in the photo in the bottom right. And the pHs range across a very wide range, pretty much 0.5 to 13 in a recent study a few years ago. Actually, historically, we've seen negative pHs, and that surprises a lot of people, but pH is the negative log of the hydrogen concentration, so you know, you get to a high enough concentration and it can go negative. And once again, similar to impoundments 3, 4, and 5, very high levels of VOCs and semivolatiles, particularly BTEX and naphthalene. And benzene is extremely high concentrations here, 207 parts per million, or approximately 20%. And that's the maximum concentration. The average concentration is still 6% benzene, so still extremely high concentrations here. And if exposed to the environment or if exposed to the humans, it would warrant IDLH conditions or immediate danger to life and health. So this was a major concern during Hurricane Irene for us. I'll get into that in a few minutes. So here's a flood hazard map for the site, and you can see the site is outlined in red here. And then the blue shows, the blue on this figure shows the 100-year flood area, and then the green shows, and it's kind of hard to see the green because the 500-year flood area doesn't really expand too much further out. But along the edges, you can see where the 500-year floodplain extends to. So just going back to where the impoundments that I'm focusing in on, impoundments 3, 4, and 5 are within the 100-year floodplain. And if you remember, there is a 100-year flood berm around this area. So impoundments 3, 4, and 5 are within that 100-year flood berm. So they're actually protected from the 100-year flood or close to it, even though this figure doesn't, this figure from FEMA doesn't necessarily indicate that. And then impoundments 1 and 2 are well within the 100-year floodplain. And if you see, we've got the Raritan River coming adjacent to the site, just like the previous figures. And you can see the yellow area is actually the floodway. So that's actually where we would see flowing waters during a major flood event. So you can see impoundments 1 and 2, with those extremely high concentrations of volatiles and semi-volatiles, are nearly within that floodway. So this was something that was a major concern to us during Hurricane Irene. So Hurricane Irene was kind of a perfect storm. It was wet conditions the 3 weeks prior. The soil was saturated. As the storm approached, New Jersey declared a state of emergency. Hurricane Irene actually hit New Jersey August 27, 2011, through the 28th, and New Jersey got up to 10 inches of rain, and we had about 7 inches of rain at the site, and 4 million people were left without power, so we didn't have power in the area of the site for approximately a week, and actual power within the site was well over a month or more, and all of New Jersey was declared as a FEMA disaster area. And one note that I thought was very interesting that I found from doing this presentation and looking into things further that I did not even realize was that Hurricane Irene actually struck New Jersey as a hurricane at the time, but the National Hurricane Center declared in December 2011, so a few months later, that it was just shy of reaching hurricane levels, I guess, based on the wind speed, and they actually downgraded it to a tropical storm after the fact. So I thought that was interesting. And one other thing that I didn't put up here is that is interesting to note, and they'll come into play later, is that Hurricane Irene hit with 7 inches of rain, or over 7 inches of rain, in August 27th and 28th, and then a little over a week later, we had Tropical Storm Lee that also hit New Jersey with up to 9.5 inches of rain in some areas of New Jersey, and I don't know the exact amount in the area of the site, but another large rain event followed approximately 10 days later. So now I'm going to talk about the impact of Hurricane Irene on the site, but I'm going to focus in on those two areas that I was referring to earlier, impoundments 3, 4, and 5 area, and the rest of the site, and then more specifically on impoundments 1 and 2, and I'll touch on that first. So here are impoundments 1 and 2. On August 29th, so the storm hit the 27th through the 28th, and I can get the cursor working here. Here we go. So you can see impoundments 1 and 2. You can see the outline of them, and you can see the earthen berm separating them. This is looking south, so the Raritan River is actually, you can see it kind of in the very back left. So this was the day after the rain event, and you can see floodwaters have almost overtopped the berms. They actually did overtop the berms on the 28th. This photo here is taken from a helicopter afterwards, so we actually missed when the berms were overtopped, but you can envision it. And a few other things to note. Our major concerns here were the failure of these berms. You know, these were not berms constructed to withstand flowing water or even floodwaters in general. I mean, these are largely just earthen berms with, you know, they're not armored, they're not, you know, they weren't really designed to for these purposes. They were constructed, you know, decades ago, essentially, to contain waste with very little, you know, extra protection for these types of flood events. So a major concern of ours was the failure of the berm, the release of the material. Just down, if you remember the figure showing the general area, there's residential communities downstream that were flooded from Hurricane Irene. You know, one concern was did contamination escape into floodwaters and migrate downstream into other communities? So there was a lot to think about here. There were a lot of concerns. So what we did to figure out if there were any issues here, looking at the bottom left figure, we collected surface water samples at a number of locations around impoundments 1 and 2 and down gradient of impoundments 1 and 2, and determined that there was no evidence of any significant release of materials. Basically nothing was detected down gradient to suggest any kind of release. And then as the floodwaters receded, the berms were continually checked, and basically we escaped unharmed. There was a little bit of tar that had splattered on the sides of the walls around the impoundments. Basically, we think that a little bit of material might have come out from the top of the impoundments, so the floodwaters may have washed over on top and washed out a little bit of material, but essentially very little impact here, and with the exception of a few minor tar splatters. So in the end, everything worked out very well. But that being said, we thought, considering this event, there were a number of things that we needed to do to be better prepared for similar events in the future. And one of those was putting a liner on the top of these impoundments. And previously, we had a water cap installed on the top of the impoundments just to minimize the release of volatiles to the atmosphere. But one measure that we took was putting these synthetic liners on the top of the impoundments to make sure that waste material did not wash out the top in future flood events. And it was also had a dual effect, too, of reducing vapor emissions as well. And then you can see the photo in the bottom right is a berm armoring project that was completed about 2 years after Hurricane Irene hit. And basically, the berms were strengthened to prevent scour and make the berms less vulnerable to flowing water and be more prepared and better equipped to handle future flood events. And then one other thing that came into play that we considered for impoundments 1 and 2 is impoundments 1 and 2, I mentioned before, are in the focus feasibility study stage, so we don't have a remedy yet. The responsible party is looking at a number of different technologies through a pilot study. It's truly an amazing advanced study and how it was performed, and I won't get too much into the details because I don't have time, but they looked at in-situ thermal treatment and in-situ solidification stabilization, as well as a combination of the two. And basically, they implemented this pilot study from a floating barge on top of the water caps of these impoundments. And they did this entire pilot study outside of hurricane season to ensure or to reduce the likelihood of any impacts from a hurricane or major flood event. And then also along those lines, I mean, they took a number of precautions as part of this study to ensure that everything would be okay if a major flood event did happen to occur. One example was they had like maybe 10 armor or 10 anchor ties that tied the whole system down and kept it from moving or being disrupted by floodwaters if they were to come higher than the tops of the berms. So in summary, impoundments 1 and 2, everything worked out all right, but we took a lot of lessons learned and made this area of the site much more prepared for any future large flood events. So then that's just impoundments 1 and 2. Going to the rest of the site and impoundments 3, 4, and 5, which are within that flood control berm. Here is the north area. So this is the area within the flood control berm, and it's looking to the east. And you can see, basically, the 100-year flood berms were overtopped, and as the floodwaters receded, the floodwaters were not able to recede within this 100-year flood control berm, and it left 5 feet of standing water, which was approximately 214 million gallons of standing water trapped within this 268-acre area. So this was a major dilemma, a massive amount of water trapped across a very large area. And another photo here, you can see all of the site trailers were kept within this area. You know, the thought was that it was within the 100-year flood control berm. It was generally safe, good location to store your office trailers, and that was not necessarily the case. The site trailers were badly flooded, and we actually lost, the PRP lost a lot of records due to this flood event. So just going through some of the impacts again, you saw the photo with 214 million gallons of standing water trapped within the north area. It was roughly 5 feet high across that entire 268-acre area. When this flood control berm was created for site operations, somebody was thinking and they put in a sluice gate or some this type of mechanical gate that allows the flood water to drain if water did become trapped. And unfortunately, at some point before Pfizer took over the site in 2009, one of the previous site owners, for some reason unknown to us and Pfizer, the previous site owner decided it would be a good idea to concrete shut the sluice gate and dismantle it. And this was unknown until immediately after the hurricane hit. So that was an unpleasant surprise. Some other impacts, the flood control berm was actually damaged in a few locations. You saw office trailers. You saw that photo of the office trailers damaged. There was no electrical power in the entire area for approximately a week. Even after that, the site remained flooded. So there was not electrical power for the entire site for well over a month. And due to that, the site's groundwater extraction system was not able to operate because there was no electricity, and then also the fact that it did not utilize submersible pumps at the time. So looking at how we responded, you know, we looked at how EPA and the PRP responded for impoundments 1 and 2. Now looking at how we kind of responded for the remainder of the site, about 12 surface water samples were collected in the vicinity of the north area to see if any of the impoundments or contaminated soils resulted in contamination of the standing water. And you can see the blue dots on this photo show where all the surface water samples were taken, and they pretty much indicated that there was really no impact. It was determined that through a controlled release or a controlled discharge of this standing water to Cuckles Brook, which I haven't pointed out yet, but this small brook flows along the site and eventually into the Raritan River, by discharging this standing water in a controlled manner, it was determined that it would not have an adverse effect on the river. So after making that determination, getting the results back from the lab, the responsible party at the site began discharging this water in a controlled fashion. They discharged 152 million gallons using generator-powered pumps, because there was no electricity. So they were actually, the photo on the left is taken alongside the 100-year flood control berm, and you can see just the sheer volume of water being discharged, and it took, you know, roughly 3 weeks to get all of this water off the site using generated generator-powered pumps. And one thing you might be thinking is it was only 152 million gallons that was pumped out of the north area, while before I mentioned there were 214 million gallons of standing water, and that was just because we couldn't get all of the water captured through this system, and some of it ultimately just migrated to groundwater or evaporated. So after all of this, some actions that we took included being more prepared in just as storm events approached and in responding to major flood events. So these two different plans were created, looking at the preparedness, such as notification procedures, preparation, evacuation procedures, and then another plan, flood management and response plan, looking at things like even rescuing people that get trapped on site, all different types of protocols like that. They're really very extensive and are very detailed, and I think overall the site is in much better shape with these two plans. Some other things that were done, the sluice gate was repaired. The office trailers were relocated out of the floodplain. If you remember the impoundment 8 facility area that was outside of the floodplain, located to the northeast of the site, the office trailers were relocated to that area so that they wouldn't be in the floodplain anymore. And then the flood control berm was repaired and armored. All of the site's electrical infrastructure was reconstructed at levels 5 feet higher than Hurricane Irene levels. So very protective, very conservative. The electrical infrastructure was put at a very high level so that site operations could continue in the future. And you can see the photo here. This is actually in the area of the groundwater extraction system and the two groundwater extraction wells. And you can see that the electrical infrastructure for that is put pretty high up. And actually, you can see look real closely, you can see the signs of previous flood events marked here. So it's about 5 feet higher than any of the previous flood levels. And then this one's kind of common sense, too. The groundwater extraction wells were replaced with submersible pumps so that they could continue to collect groundwater throughout future flood events. And that was kind of a no-brainer. So some other impacts that Hurricane Irene had kind of longer term, not immediately following or an immediate reaction to Hurricane Irene. In September 2012, roughly a year after Hurricane Irene hit, a remedy was selected for the entire site except for impoundments 1 and 2, which are on their own separate track and are currently in the FFS focus feasibility study stage. But the rest of the site, a remedy was selected in 2012, and we're currently in the design phase. And that remedy called for all different types of caps. I don't want to get too much into the details, but called for different capping systems, either impermeable synthetic caps or soil caps across almost 200 acres of the site. And one requirement that we included in the ROD was that all of the engineered capping systems had to be designed and constructed to withstand the effects of a 500-year flood event. So this was included just considering the high likelihood of the site being exposed to flood events in the future. And then another influence that Hurricane Irene had a little bit more indirectly is one thing that we heard in the public comment period for the ROD from the community was that they were concerned that putting a cap across such a large area of the site might exacerbate flooding in nearby residential communities. So one thing that came about from the public comment period was that we established a goal in the ROD of minimizing the loss of flood storage. So in the design phase now, the responsible party is looking at ways to minimize losses of flood storage and see if they can handle flooding better and not cause any additional flooding to nearby properties. And then another example is the Removal Action Wastewater Treatment Plant. I won't get into it, but essentially a temporary wastewater treatment plant was constructed as part of a removal action. You can see it on in the photo on the bottom right. It was actually constructed directly adjacent to impoundments 1 and 2, and it was constructed on about a 10-foot stone platform to keep it completely out of floodwaters, and that way it wouldn't be damaged in future flood events and could continue operation during or shortly after future flood events. And then one other example that I don't have on here is in the design phase now, I mentioned that we have groundwater extraction wells, or two groundwater extraction wells operating currently. Those are pursuant to a New Jersey DEP order from the late 1980s. Part of the OU4 remedy includes a groundwater component to the remedy that calls for a much more extensive collection and treatment of groundwater. And in that process, the responsible party and EPA have determined that it would be best to include the wastewater treatment plant for that groundwater that's extracted. The placement of that groundwater treatment plant will be at the Impoundment 8 facility, which is that area of the site that is not within the floodplain. So that's another effect that it had. So just a few lessons learned and take-home messages for you guys. I think I'm running low on time here. A few lessons learned are if you have site trailers or any important critical infrastructure and you can put it outside of the floodplain, you should probably do it, including wastewater treatment plants, trailers, anything like that. Any waste and equipment you can store outside of the floodplain, it's probably a good idea. And then, if you have berms that are critical to your site, for containing waste or any other reasons, try to inspect them at least on a semi-annual basis and make sure there's not any issues with their integrity. And, evaluate whether berm armoring is necessary or and elevate critical infrastructure if you can. And then, also looking at, 100-year flood event seems to be occurring quite frequently these days. So consider remedies that are able to withstand 500-year flood events or something greater than 100-year flood events if you can. And then finally, develop plans and develop flood plans to be better prepared in the future and so that you're ready to go and can handle future flood events in a better manner. And I think with that, I'll pass it back to Jean.
All right, just a gentle reminder. We have had a couple of questions come in electronically, but participants can still type them up. I think we're going to work with Carlos here to take just one or two questions before moving on to the next talk. So, Carlos, did you see anything you were interested in reading out loud?
Yes, thanks. Thanks, Jean and Joe. Thank you very much. We're going to move on to Yang Chang, but make sure she has time to cover material, and then we'll have a more open-ended discussion at the end. There are several outstanding questions, but there is one here specific to you. I think you covered it, but maybe you want to recap. The question is, what is a berm armoring material, an anchored synthetic cover or something else?
Yeah, so there's a couple different berm armoring materials that you can use, and I'm not too familiar with all of them, but I can speak to two. The one that we used was more of a vegetative type material. You can also do more of a concrete-based berm armoring, and originally a concrete-based armor was being considered for impoundments 1 and 2, but it was determined that the very low pH in those impoundments could affect the integrity of that of the concrete armor over time. So we opted for a vegetative armor that may not have been quite as strong as a concrete armor, but it was certainly strong enough to do the job in this case.
Okay,
so I think it's...
Thanks very much, and thanks again, Joe. So now Jean is bringing up the slides for Young Chang, our last speaker of the day. Young earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Civil Engineering from Virginia Tech. She has worked with the Emergency and Remedial Response Division of the EPA Region 2 office since 95. She was first project officer managing engineering services and contract, and as a remedial project manager managing multi-million-dollar Superfund sites since 97. She currently manages the Richardson Hill Road and Sydney Landfill sites and the Grass River, also known as Alcoa Aggregation Site, which is the topic of her presentation. It's a large and is a large sediment remediation site. And Young is currently serving as co-chair of the Contaminated Sediments Forum. So Young, if you're with us, I hand it off to you.
Great. Thank you, Carlos. Good afternoon. As Carlos explained, I've been with EPA for over 20 years, and I've been the project manager for the Grass River site since mid-2004. I'm going to talk about how we adapted to weather impacts at the Grass River site. Jean?
Yep, I'm here, and if you need any help, Young, I'm going to go ahead and check one more thing here, and let's see if you can go ahead and click those slides now.
Yes. So the Grass River is 115 miles long, and it flows northeasterly from the foothills of the Adirondacks into the St. Lawrence River. The Grass River site itself is located in Messina, New York, bordering Cornwall, Canada. The site is actually the lower 7.2 mile, which is from the confluence of the Power Canal down into the St. Lawrence River. That's 7.2 miles. And the Power Canal I speak of is this stretch here. Oops, let me get the pointer. This is the Power Canal. And from the confluence of the Power Canal into the St. Lawrence is about 7.2 mile stretch. The site is contaminated with PCB in the sediment, water, and biota. So in the next two slides, I'm going to share a bit of history on how the river's development impacted the location of the contamination in the sediment. From 1898 to 1903, the Power Canal was constructed. With cheap energy being available, Pittsburgh Reduction Company, also known as Alcoa now, constructed an aluminum plant in Messina in 1902. And to support that increased flow from the powerhouse, which you see on the left photo, the lower Grass River itself was excavated and widened. So while the powerhouse was operating for over 50 years, not much sediment was being deposited over the lower Grass River. The Power Canal and the powerhouse ceased operation in 1958 when the FDR project on the St. Lawrence River was started and supplying energy to Messina and nearby area, including the Alcoa plant. The picture you see is the Moses Saunders Power Dam, along with the Eisenhower Lock System, make up the FDR project. So the figure at the bottom right displays a typical lower Grass River cross-section. The early 1900s development deepened and widened the river to the current state of 15 to 25 feet depth and 400 to 600 feet width on average. And it created very steep banks and also side slopes. Later, when I speak of near shore, I am speaking of, let me get the pointer, this area where it is shallower water is considered the near shore. What I call main channel is this stretch with a deeper water depth. Once the power canal stopped operating, the flow of the river drastically slowed, and the main channel started to accumulate sediment. So now some contaminant history. Alcoa had discharged waste oil containing PCBs through multiple outlets and the unnamed tributary, and it stopped using PCBs in the mid-70s. Under the New York State DEC order, Alcoa completed the upland site remediation in 2001, which eliminated the source of the PCB contamination into the Grass River. These events explain why the highest PCB concentration at the Grass River site is located near the bottom of the sediment column and overlain by cleaner sediment at the top. So the Grass River site is a non-MPL site. It's not on the national priority list. However, it functions like one because EPA issued an order to Alcoa in 1989 for the investigation, alternatives development, design, implementation of the remedial action at the site. In 95, Alcoa was ordered to conduct a non-time critical removal action, which removed approximately 3,000 cubic yards of the highest PCB contamination in the sediment, along with boulders and debris from the outfall 001 area. For over a decade, numerous studies have been conducted to define the extent of the contamination and to develop the cleanup alternatives for the site. Along the way, several pilot studies and demonstration projects have also been implemented. One of those pilot studies was the 2001 capping pilot study, the objectives of which were to evaluate cap coverage effectiveness, extent of entrainment, water quality impacts, benthic organism impact, and the cost on various cap materials design and placement techniques. So as a component of the long-term monitoring, the caps were monitored both in 2002 and 2003. Good results were shown in 2002. CAP is still in place. However, with the results from 2003 monitoring, the team discovered that some of the capping material, along with the underlying contaminated sediment, had been eroded, but did not know by what mechanism. So prior to this discovery, the team had gathered extensive information regarding the site sediment stability, CAP stability under various flow conditions, including high flow events, both 100-year events and 500-year events. However, it was not aware of, nor did they anticipate the potential for scouring due to ice jam events. As a side note, before this event, EPA Region 2 was getting ready to finalize the Grass River proposed plan. But of course, after this discovery, the team needed to go back to the drawing board. So before I proceed explaining the type of investigation that that went on after the 2003, I just wanted to explain the concept of scouring and when there is a severe ice jam event. So this is a profile of an ice jam. When the water is flowing from left to right, so northeasterly direction at the site, great amount of broken ice pieces float down from upriver into and get stopped by a very thick, competent ice cover that still exists within the lower Grass River. And the lower Grass ice is thicker and stays longer intact because of the deeper water depth and a slower, lower flow rate. So the broken pieces of ice starts accumulating and develops this toe. The toe of the ice jam is created by accumulation of the broken ices coming in contact with the solid ice cover downstream. It's not the broken piece of ice itself that gouged into the cap and into the sediment, but the restriction of the area where the same amount of water still needs to flow through creates a much higher flow velocity, along with the turbulence that's created that scours the sediment. So this is a photo of an ice run, broken pieces of ice running down the river, ice run, from March 2003. This type of photo on the Grass River does not necessarily equal severe ice jam event. This is pretty typical at site, at Grass River site, in early spring of any winter. The next two slides list the types of studies that Alcoa had conducted to understand the ice jam-related resuspension, characterize the event, and to determine the relevance of the event to the future remedial alternatives. So I won't bore you by reading all of them. However, the more interesting ones that led to forecasting or hindcasting what the historical frequency of these ice jam events are the hindcasting analysis itself, the tree scarring survey, and then also those stratigraphic analysis of sediment cores using cesium dating. So this slide shows bed elevation change from 2001 prior to the capping, or after the capping, and also 2003 bathymetry taken of the capping pilot study area. The brown and darker the brown depicts greater amount of erosion. The blue and the darker blue shows greater amount of deposition. So by this point, which was May of 2003, the team was aware that erosion occurred, but did not know the cause behind that erosion. Ice investigation concluded that the upper 1.8 miles of the Lower Grass River is susceptible to scouring caused by severe ice jam events. Not all of the sediments within that upper 1.8 mile stretch will scour during a severe ice jam event. And historic frequency have been predicted to be about once every 8 to 10 years. And the near shore shallow zone sediments are not significantly impacted by ice jam events. This is a time series schematic Alcoa created based on the photographs taken from March 26th through March 29th. The light blue is solid, intact ice cover. The darker blue shows open water, and the orange or the yellow depicts broken pieces of ice running through. So on the March 26th, everything is copacetic. The pink, by the way, the pink is noting the capping pilot study area. The reason why this area is blue on March 26th and it stays blue as open water because that zone is very shallow, rapidly moving water body. And so that zone gets thawed out much quicker than any other area of the Grass River. By the 27th, you start seeing the broken pieces of ice. By the 28th, you see the broken pieces of ice formed and right at the edge of the capping pilot study location. And below that, most of the ice is still intact. Between the 28th and 29th is when the ice out occurred. Here's another photo taken on March 28th prior to the ice out. The thing to note is the broken pieces of the ice are piled up in the main channel approximately 4 feet above the water level in that main channel. And if you look at the near shore, the ice looks to be intact. So based on the ice investigation results, Alcoa evaluated both structural and non-structural options to address scouring due to severe ice jam events. I'll show these options in upcoming slides, except for the ice boom. I don't have a picture for that. Some form of ice booms have been successfully used at the mouth of the Niagara River for several decades, and it was considered for Grass River site as well. But the conclusion of that study determined that it was inadequate for our site situation, so we didn't proceed any further. So this is a conceptual site plan for a ice control structure located at transect T6.75. So this is within our site location, conceptualized but never constructed in field. The little yellow dots you see are the piers coming out of the water surface, and it needs to be anchored into the solid bedrock beneath. Ice control structure such as this has been used in New York State before, and there is one constructed at Cazenovia Creek in New York. The purpose of that was to prevent flooding in the nearby residences along that creek. So the conceptual ice control structure at T6.75 was also physically modeled at the Army Corps Cold Regions Laboratory in New Hampshire. So the red sticks that you see coming out is supposed to represent the piers. The width and the length and the bottom contours are representing the site itself, so it's constructed to represent the Grass River site. As a potential interim measure, ice breaking was demonstrated on the full lower Grass River site in March 2007. The ice breaking basically consisted of a barge with two long arm excavators sitting on top, breaking away at ice. It started at the downstream end at the confluence where St. Lawrence River, where Reynolds site is located along the St. Lawrence River, and it went up river towards Power Canal and back and forth. One of the major problems that we had was refreezing occurring because the temperatures were so low during that particular season. Every time they break through, it would come back and refreeze, which made the project duration twice as long as originally anticipated. So what was the overall impact to the site and to the remedy? Our conceptual site model had changed as a result of the 9 additional years of various investigations that were performed. Pre-2003 draft proposed plan had capping component, but it did not take scouring due to ice jam events into consideration, whereas the 2012 proposed plan that went out, that was released to the public, also has a capping component for the upper 2 miles, but with armoring proposed to prevent the scouring due to ice jam events. In addition, since 2003, Alcoa has been monitoring the ice on an annual basis, documenting the ice formation in winter and breakup in spring. Monitoring includes climate conditions, river stage and flow monitoring, ice thickness measurements, running numerical simulations, and photo documentation. EPA selected the remedy in 2013 with 3 major components. The near shore contaminated sediment shown in yellow will be dredged and backfilled to grade with habitat reconstruction, whereas the main channel upper 2 mile shown in green or lime green will get 12-inch chemical isolation and gravel filtering layer with 13-inch armor stone layer on top. Whereas the lower 5 mile shown in blue, the main channel of the lower 5 mile will be capped with a 12-inch sand and topsoil mix. And in conclusion, the site will also continue to monitor after remedy implementation and adapt were needed to ensure that the remedy is still protective, including climate change-related vulnerabilities will be considered in the future monitoring. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Young. Oh, there you are, Jean.
Yep, there I am. I think we have time for just one or two questions here before we walk through some final reminders and close out today's webinar. So for anyone who does have to hop off the line, we first want to thank you so much for joining us. If you can stay on for just another moment or two, please do so. We'll go through just a few more questions. But if you do have to hop off, you can certainly reach out directly to any of the organizers via email. Their presenter information is available on the seminar homepage if we weren't able to get through your question today. I think I'm going to take one question, and I'm going to pose it to both Joe and to Young that came from the public, or probably from the participants today. A few people have brought up the concept of notifying or involving the community when there are risks. Can you talk in each one of your sites what you did for notification or how the public was notified regarding these issues as a result of a climate change issue? And Young, let's start with you.
Okay. So for Grass River site, we have a working group citizen advisory panel, or we had a citizen advisory panel until the remedy was chosen. Now it's more a bigger group. But during that time, this CAP group existed. So they're updated on a regular basis. So meetings were held at that time, and also I believe there was a public information session to inform the public what had happened. On top of that, Alcoa is quite good at sending out a general newsletter of what's occurring on the grass, and we also have a website. So there were many outreach done to inform the public of the current site situation. And every time there is a pilot study conducted or a demonstration project conducted at the Grass River, we also have a massive outreach to the public through public meetings, through public availability sessions, and also through newsletters that go out.
All right, excellent. Thanks. Joe, how about for you and your site when you had those flooding problems? How did you notify or work with the local community?
So, I guess in terms of just regularly updating them, updating the community, we have quarterly updates, and we have a tag recipient that's responsible for disseminating information to the public. We also took a lot of the community's concerns regarding flooding in during the public comment period for the ROD, which helped help kind of alleviate some of the concerns up front rather than letting them develop later on during flood events. But in terms of notifying the community during during and immediately following Hurricane Irene, it was really primarily through the local newspaper, through a number of stories. I mean, it was, frankly, it was tough to, with so much going on, you know, both related to the site and just flooding in general. I mean, so many communities downstream were very severely flooded, and you know, frankly, no one was going to be reading the distribution email or the you know, some of the more typical lines of communication. And you know, I think we did a lot of communication with local newspapers to really get the word out as best as we could.
All right, excellent. Thank you.
And Jean, actually, I've got to sign off. I've got another call at 4 that they're waiting for me on, but thank you.
Let's go ahead and turn back to Carlos Pachon and Ann Daly to see if there are any final closing thoughts you want to leave the audience with or specific resources that you could point them to when they're trying to consider climate change adaptation at their particular sites. And then we'll walk through the final reminders and close things out today.
No, I just want to recognize that there are quite a few questions we have not been able to answer. I think the types of questions and the fact that they're being answered is one of the goals of this webinar, is to start asking ourselves. So while we haven't been able to provide a direct answer, I think they're definitely the types of questions. Now, we are, our points of contact are included in the opening page. So if any of those questions were directed at one of us individually, please do feel free to send us an email and ask it, and we'll try to follow up with you. Appreciate all of your time. Thanks for finding the time and to be with us. And I'll ask Ann and over to you for any other thoughts. Or
yeah, just encourage folks to take a look at the web page that we'd identified earlier and some of the resources we do have. A lot of really good links there that provide good resources, as well as our contaminant fact sheets that we put together on climate change. There's the one on groundwater. There's the one on containment remedies, and coming soon, one on sediment sites as well. So take a look at those. And that, again, we provided that address, but if you go into Google and type in Superfund climate change, it'll pop right up. So please take a look at that. And if you have any suggestions of improvements that we can make to that, we certainly would appreciate getting those to you, because this is a really living thing as it's as we get more and more information. And if there are any site examples that you think would be good to include, particularly West Coast examples, we'd like to get some of those. So yeah, please be in contact, and look forward to any feedback folks can provide. Thanks so much for spending the time with us today.
All right, excellent. Thank you so much. Let me just walk that audience through of just a final reminder here. We did have nearly 250 individuals join us from around the U.S. today. If you'd like to stay connected with us at the Cleanup Information Network, you can find us at cluein.org, or feel free to follow or connect with us on popular social and professional networking sites. Just a reminder, as was mentioned, the presentation materials, including contact information and some of the supplemental fact sheets and tip sheets and other websites, are available on the resources or links page. That page will be active from this point forward. So if you have any problems downloading it, you can take your time. It's not going away anytime soon. The other one is for those of you watching the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still follow those links and click on the seminar resources. Resources or seminars, link those files from your own computer through the archive session. Or site examples you'd like to share, and I will ask one last time if you can take just a moment and fill out our short online feedback form to help ensure that we can continue to offer free internet seminars like this in the future. If you shared the line with multiple parties, each person can actually fill out the feedback form on their own. There'll be a link to let the next person hop on and complete the form after you. If you don't have time now, you can come back to that feedback form at any point and share your thoughts with us. And of course, again, for those of you lucky enough to replay today's webinar, you can still share your thoughts through that online feedback form through the related URLs pod on the middle right of your page. Again, thank you so very much for joining us for today's live broadcast. You will receive an automatic email as soon as the recorded version of today's webinar is available for free replay and download. This will be the formal conclusion.